Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Sociology. I'm your host this week, Arturo Baiocchi, and in each episode, we look at a new sociology book and talk with its author. And this week, we have Teresa Gowan, author of Hobos, Hustlers, and Backsliders, Homeless in San Francisco, published by University of Minnesota Press. Dr. Gowan's book comes out of her multi-year ethnography in San Francisco, where she was initially looking at homeless recyclers and the way that they negotiate the informal recycling economy of the city. But over time, the project expanded more broadly to look at how these individuals negotiate other institutions, such as those related to corrections, shelters, and treatment centers, and how they're exposed to different languages and understandings of what homelessness is all about and what are the root causes of homelessness. And so Dr. Gowan's book is kind of an empirical reporting of how individuals themselves who use these services take up the language provided by these institutions to make sense of who they are and the daily struggles that they face. Anyway, I hope you stick around to listen to this very interesting interview. And without further ado, here we go. All right, so today we have Teresa Gowan, author of Hobos, Hustlers, and the Backsliders, Homelessness in San Francisco. And Teresa, the first thing I wanted to say, just thank you for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. It's a wonderful opportunity.
Now, to have full disclosure, I have to say that Teresa is part of the U of M, University of Minnesota Sociology faculty, where I'm also a graduate student. So it is not just pure luck that I ran into your book, but I have to say I did enjoy reading it. I was reading some chapters last night to prepare for the interview, and I loved how you wrote the book. I really like the style of the writing that you did, and it seems like you weave in kind of policy analysis with your ethnography, and the stories kind of go in and out of the writing. So I really enjoyed just the way you organized the book.
Great, yeah.
Just to start out, you know, how did you come to study homelessness in San Francisco? I mean, can you?
Well, yeah, there was a lot of different things I could have been studying. I started the project when I was, a relatively sort of junior graduate student. And I was living in the Mission District in San Francisco and just off of 24th Street, which is a sort of major pedestrian, you know, and as well as transit corridor and, you know, very vital kind of street. And there was all of these guys pushing these carts loaded up with bottles and cans on them past my door. And I would hear them coming along. They were partly, you know, looking for stuff to recycle in the public bins, but they were also just people who had been doing that elsewhere and just coming along there on their way to sell the stuff. So basically, you know, it was this time where there was a lot of talk, as there has been since, you know, the early 80s in San Francisco about, you know, the large homelessness problem and what should be done about it and who are these people. And I was seeing these guys who were incredibly hard workers. And, you know, the one thing that really struck me was like, well, these guys are major manual workers. And that's actually not what I'm hearing about homelessness. I mean, I'm hearing about mental illness and, you know, drug addiction and, you know, criminality to some extent. And I'm hearing about homeless families. But I'm not really hearing about this kind of major workforce that seems to be, right, you know, involved in the informal recycling industry. So that just kind of intrigued me. And to be honest, I think I projected onto those guys a little bit before I even knew them, because the older white guys who were, you know, these sort of grizzled manual workers, they really reminded me of my uncles back in the UK. And, you know, I was sort of thinking like, well, what would be happening to them right now if it wasn't for, you know, the welfare state, because, you know, my Uncle Jack, for example, had been out of work for a long time. So, you know, I sort of had this sort of ready-made empathy, I guess, going into the project, which got me kind of excited to go out there and talk to them.
What was the goal of the project that you kind of eventually developed into this book? I mean, what were you trying to find out exactly?
Well, it started off a bit, you know, differently from how it finished, like most projects. So, you know, I was really interested in the recyclers, the homeless recyclers, and their role within the waste management industry. So I had more of a kind of, I guess you'd call it an informal economy interest, basically seeing them as being the return of say the figure of the rag picker from, mm-hmm. you know, before the, you know, the great changes of the New Deal, where, you know, there were people who lived on the bottom of society off of other people's discards, you know, that this basically this was part of the of a return of a more informal economy, more characteristic of the global South in the richest country in the world. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of examples you can point to as indicators of that. So I thought that that would be an interesting angle to deliberately treat these guys as workers, you know, who were homeless, rather than look at them as, you know, the, mm-hmm. these multi-problem individuals that I was reading about in the literature, you know, on homelessness, which at that time, you know, was completely dominated by this kind of extremely individualized, pathologizing view of what homeless people were.
Right. Yeah, I feel like there's a whole chapter, the hobo chapter. We seem to argue that recyclers are kind of the new archetype of, or the hobo archetype of these self-reliant, individualistic personas that are surviving by doing this informal, working in this informal economy, as they're almost as entrepreneurs. Part of the waste management system.
Yeah, no, that absolutely. I mean, you know, whether they saw themselves as entrepreneurs or workers or even hobos, you know, because I basically, you know, it was them who came up with the idea that they were the new hobos and not me. You know, that really depended on their existing politics and where they were coming from. And I found people claiming to be, you know, like the hobos or new hobos in three different parts of the city. And I was never clear if this was an idea which had been started by the one guy who I call Morris, who was really this wonderful sort of intellectual of the recycling, homeless recycling crowd, and that it had spread from him, or if it was something that people came up with separately in different places. But
so really going back to this lineage of, you know, what the hobos did in the beginning of the century and is somehow speaking to what they're doing almost as an identity, I guess, huh? Like where they're trying to find a place in between, you know, what you keep going back to the kind of pathology myths of the homeless and as being poor or as being lazy.
Yes.
You know, like they're neither lazy nor sick. They're hobos.
Exactly. Neither lazy nor sick. Yeah. I mean, this one, I could just give you a quick quote if you like. I mean,
yeah, that'd
you know,
be great.
From this guy Morris that I was talking about, he said, you know, people think that the hobos were these free spirits, you know, hopping trains, traveling the country. It's all got the Disney treatment now. And I ain't saying that there wasn't good times, but you've got to remember the freedom had another side. Most of those guys worked very hard, just like we do. A man that would not work, they would call him a tramp, a yegg. He was no hobo. Hobos, they were working men, and people forget that. And, you know, what he's saying is we are the true hobo element. We do this hard, dirty work. We have nothing. But the good side is that we are free. We don't have to take too much bullshit. Now, I mean, of course, he did have to take bullshit a lot and, you know, would get very angry about it. But the bullshit he's talking about is rather different, you know, from that of the hobos of 1904. You know, like a lot of what would get him and his colleagues most upset was being treated like idiots and, you know, sort of forced to articulate their lives in terms of, you know, that how their individual problems and weaknesses had led them into homelessness over and over again in order to get services. And they found it extremely demeaning. So actually, a lot of these guys lived very independently of the services in San Francisco. So even though, as you say, San Francisco is a center for homeless services, a lot of these guys actually had very, you know, very little contact with the social service infrastructure there because they had unpleasant experiences with it.
Reading your book, you get the sense that these are really resilient individuals who have to work to survive. And yet to get supports, they almost have to subscribe to what it sounds to them is kind of a demeaning identity of either being sick or being lazy, but something definitely is wrong with them. And that's why I enjoyed the book and how you kind of frame the three different ways that homelessness is understood throughout the different public policies that have existed. So mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about these different types of talks that you mentioned early on in the book, and you kind of then used to kind of frame how these individuals themselves understand and take up that language and sometimes resist that language.
Yeah, no, definitely I can. I mean, you know, the book's got this this schema, which is quite sort of simple. And the idea is that there's these three constructions of homelessness and indeed of poverty that we've come to kind of get used to duking it out in the public sphere in America. So basically, I argue that there's sin talk and sick talk, you know, the very pathologizing these poor people, you know, like they all have multiple problems with substance abuse, mental illness, lack of social capital, etc. This kind of talk, which was predominant, you know, among the social worker kind of lair in the city, although by no means like the only way that they thought. Right. And then there was this quite strong, but less than the other two, discourse of system talk, which really did, you know, turn the gaze away from the homeless person themselves and said, look, why are we generating so much homelessness here? You know, and so this would look on the local level at, you know, like obviously the extremely high cost of living and lack of affordable housing, but also, you know, at the job structure, why there was like so few jobs, you know, entry level jobs in construction, for example, which was doing well, you know, through the mid 90s, at least in California, when it had fallen apart in other places. But somehow, like, these kinds of guys were just not getting into those jobs. So people be looking at institutional racism, at lack of affordable housing, and then, you know, at the broader picture of the changes in the American economy to explain what was going on with homelessness and, you know, obviously to the lessening safety net. I mean, so those who were doing the system talk, which is, you know, like, preeminently the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness, who are really just a fantastic organization, always run just by a handful of people, but just very, very committed to getting their message out there and just continuing to push a systemic discourse, you know, is something which was extremely valuable, you know, not only just within the political debate, you know, from my perspective, but, you know, also for people on the street who would actually read, you know, the Street Sheet, their publication, and you know, feel that they could say, the problem is not me, perhaps it's not me who's fucked up, you know, which was you know, something which I heard all the time. It's like, why is it always about me and all of my issues? You know, there's other stuff going on which is affecting my life chances here. Why is nobody talking about that? And so the coalition echoed these feelings and legitimated them for people in a really powerful way. And, you know, that I think that's also something which is very unique about San Francisco, how strong system talk, you know, has remained in that city despite all of the defeats of the last 20 years. It's really extraordinary.
What I really liked about the project as it seemed like it developed from just looking at recycling was how people themselves take up these discourses. Because, I mean, most people have heard these things, right? That homelessness is a result of not working hard enough, or the medicalization of homelessness, right? That the closing down of hospitals has led to this wave of mentally ill people. And while that's probably true to a certain extent, that's a definite campaign policy that people are aware of. And also this issue of affordable housing. But what I really liked about the book was then empirically, what does this mean on the ground? Like, how do homeless individuals come to understand their own predicament, you know, in the city where these things seem to be going, like it seems to be kind of a ground zero of homelessness advocacy in a way. And so I was wondering if we can kind of talk a little bit about what you actually discovered. I mean, how do people, do they adapt to these discourses? Do they reject them? Do they accept them?
Well, right. So, you know, as we were talking about before, I started off with the recyclers, right? And so uh-huh. they were very interesting discursively. And in fact, that's what pushed me in this direction of looking at sin talk and sick talk and system talk and seeing how, you know, how people were negotiating those discourses and the institutions, you know, which were you know, very materially shaping their lives through, you know, using those discourses. It was the recyclers who took me there because, you know, they would just keep telling me, you know, I'm not a bum, I'm not criminal, I'm not sick. And, you know, that they would, you know, for example, they didn't need to go down my street. If you remember at the beginning, I was saying that, you know, like all of these homeless recyclers were always going past my street. It's actually quite a busy street. And, you know, I only realized after a while that a lot of them weren't even collecting anything. They already had completely full carts, you know, with like 10 extra garbage bags tied around the edge, you know, like perhaps 200 pounds of bottles that they were lugging along the street. They actually would have been much better to take a quieter street like 23rd Street or 25th Street. But they wanted to display their hard work to the population,
right,
and say, look, you know, we're not that thing you think we are. You know, and in fact, you know, obviously they succeeded with me because I got interested in them, you know, and wanted to kind of look at that further. But, you know, they were.
So you're saying they're making a statement, like,
yes,
here I am.
Absolutely.
And I'm here loud. I'm slowing down traffic. You have to acknowledge me as a.
Exactly.
As a real.
They would, go right into the traffic sometimes. And like they would use, you know, very assertive hand signals to hold up the traffic when they were taking heavy loads across intersections, for example. And, you know, it was extraordinary to me, especially as I was doing, you know, some comparative research in St. Louis at the time. And the homeless recyclers there were like skulking around and always worried that someone that they knew would see them, you know. And so this is what really alerted me to how performative, you know, the recycling was. It wasn't just about the money. It was about honor, you know. So basically, the recycling scene did become a kind of hotbed of a homeless version of the kind of system talk of the coalition, even though there wasn't that much interaction between the two bodies, because these guys did not live in the Tenderloin where the coalition is housed. You know, they basically avoided it because they saw it as a sort of center of sin talk and, you know, like this drug economy and a lot of sort of bad behavior and people who are much more invested in being, you know, in the criminal economy. And so they just didn't like it there at all. They didn't like the streets there. And then they didn't like the institutions because it's also like a major institutional center for homeless folks, right? So they didn't like having to be, you know, pathetic and sick inside of the shelters. And they didn't like being ripped off and, you know, abused out on the sidewalk and offered drugs if they were trying to stay off of them, right? So they hated the Tenderloin, you know, the TL in general. And they didn't have that much contact with the coalition, but they did like the street sheet. And, you know, this...
Which is a newspaper?
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
What is that?
It's one of those sort of homeless newspapers that, you know, basically they give them out to homeless folks to sell, and they can sell them for a dollar each. And, you know, this is a kind of program they have in a lot of cities. But, you know, my sense is that the street sheet is really one of the most excellent of these publications. And it really avoids, you know, either sentimentalizing or pathologizing, you know, the homeless folks themselves. And, you know, names in a way which is very dignifying, you know. So like if somebody's got a first person account, it's you know, their name is right in there. Whereas, you know, the whole kind of medicalizing approach is that these vulnerable people need to be sort of, you know, their identities need to be protected because it's so shameful, and they need to be, you know, they can't be trusted to make any decisions for themselves, you know. So I think even just by the very character of the way it presents its homeless writers and homeless interviewees in the stories, the street sheet sends a message like there's nothing shameful about this person. It's what's happening to them that is shameful, you know, which is, it's almost like a subliminal message behind the message, which I think the guys picked up on very, very strongly.
So it dignifies, this dignified version of homelessness resonates with the recyclers.
Absolutely, absolutely. And some of them were more radical than others. Like I said, you know, so there was people who were into being hunter-gatherers. There were people who were more had the entrepreneurial model, as you were saying earlier. And there was a lot of folks who, you know, saw it as a kind of blue collar work. And we're really recreating the sort of camaraderie and, you know, sort of sense of honor of being a blue collar worker. So in fact, the competition, I mean, you know, my sense was that I went in expecting to find a more entrepreneurial thing going on, but I found very little competition. And in fact, a sort of almost an ethic of subduing the competition as much as possible. And so I actually felt that the kind of
so
work
between the recyclers, you mean?
Yeah.
They weren't competing for, you know, if there's a good place to get cans or get cardboard boxes, they would
exactly
work together.
Okay. Exactly. They worked together. They would tell each other about good places to go. I mean, I was continually being told good places to get stuff. Hmm. For example, when I started out, because I was doing it myself. And you know, I'm at one point I said to this one guy, he had just told a guy called Dennis, like, his best place where he got stuff. I was like, why do you tell him about that? You know, you fill up a whole load over there, you know. And, you know, why did you tell him? And he's like, oh, well, he's a good guy. He wouldn't go in and clean up, you know, ahead of me. He wouldn't do that. You know,
like he wouldn't take everything.
He wouldn't take everything because he would know that would be a mean thing to do, you know. So there was this kind of giving each other the benefit of the doubt, which, you know, included across race lines, which was actually quite inspiring, I thought. So it was less entrepreneurial in some ways and more of a sort of a team of workers, even though they were each working for themselves. They actually broke down the structure which was encouraged by the system, which is obviously that you just take your own stuff in. They broke it down to some extent. Some people worked together and a lot of people stockpiled together. You know, so they would like, you know, collect a whole bunch and then take it in, you know, as a group. So, you know.
Was there any kind of, I don't remember in the book if you mentioned this, if there's this feeling that they're making use out of things that we throw away, this kind of critique of a over consumerist society and how we just go through resources and here they are, the supposedly, you know, people who are pathological, but they're actually taking our trash and creating value out of it. Was there any kind of critiques like that?
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite broad. I mean, you know, not everybody went as far as the hunter-gatherer types who, you know, had a very strong critique and, you know, really considered that in such an affluent city, they could get absolutely everything they needed from the garbage. So they were sort of like freegans, right? So, but that was just one little group that I knew. I mean, I think in general, though, there's something about spending your life jumping in and out of dumpsters, which makes you kind of have those ideas to some extent. So even people who really did not have much kind of alternative exposure to, you know, alternative ideas of, you know, how people should live actually became, you know, really avid dumpster divers. And even though they were mostly looking for bottles and cans, they would always be sort of saying, God, it's amazing what people throw away. And they would bring me presents constantly out of the garbage. You know, I was just...
Oh, yeah,
there's a steady stream of, like, you know, blenders and sweaters and just stereos and stuff.
Oh, wow.
You know, that.
Did you keep that stuff?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I have no problem with dumpster diving. I did plenty of it myself. So yeah, I mean, I think there's something about living on the bottom which makes you notice what people throw away, right? And it's kind of marvel at it, especially, you know, those who had, you know, sort of like lower middle class, say, lives, you know, and had taken this stuff for granted. And suddenly they were like, this is perfectly good. Why would you throw it away? So in some ways, they became rather unmaterialistic from being homeless, like, you know, over a longer period. So they, for example, they didn't really care that much about what they ate anymore. They didn't sort of see themselves as suffering from, you know, like bad food or anything. You know, the vast majority of people, they were just like, oh, there's enough food around and I can pick it up somewhere. And, you know, they'd go to one of the soup kitchens or, you know, like they'd had people working in the taquerias, for example, in the mission who would just give them yesterday's beans or something. And, you know, they were just kind of like, ah, it's food. You know, we're lucky. So people in Africa are starving. They would say stuff like that. So there was this weird sort of downshifting of expectations on the material level, which, you know, really, I guess I was really blown away by that. I thought there was something kind of wonderful about it, that they, you know, if as long as these guys had, you know, friends, had people to watch their back, you know, had people who respected them, they were even able to survive you know, like all the stigma and deprivation of being homeless and not actually be like completely miserable.
Now, how do they understand? I mean, do they understand recycling as a way to eventually get out of homelessness, or would they, do they even see themselves in a precarious situation that they have to get out of homelessness? And I guess, like, how does the, how does that kind of contrast with maybe some of the other respondents that you interviewed in terms of their appreciation of this system analysis of why they're homeless?
Okay, so getting out of homelessness, yep, it's amazing how people kind of stop doing that after a while. You know, I mean, basically, Snow and Anderson, you know, who did one of the first great sort of studies of the return of mass homelessness in the U.S. Down on their luck, you know, that they talked about straddlers, people in this in-between limbo where they've become homeless, but they haven't accepted it yet, you know, and they're sort of trying to get back in. Now, a lot of straddlers do get back in. You know, a lot of people who are homeless are only homeless for a short time. But then, you know, if you stay homeless for, you know, more than a few months, in order to survive psychically, you can't carry on seeing it as the desperate, dreadful thing that you have been seeing it, or you'll go crazy, you know. And so basically people adapt to it. And the interesting thing is that, you know, plans about not being homeless anymore tend to recede, you know, for pretty well, like, most of the people I got to know. And, you know, it wasn't something they talked about that much. With recycling, in some ways, what they would dream about is not so much not being homeless, but being homeless in a much better way. So they would dream about getting a pickup truck and being a bigger recycler, you know, but still right, doing it, because they actually kind of liked the work and by then rather expert at it. So they're like, yeah, I'm going to get a van like some of those, you know, some of those Latin guys, you know, and then I'll make a lot of money. So, you know, that was the dream of like several of the long-term recycling folks that I knew. So, I mean, that's the first question. I mean, in terms of, like, you know, comparing their perspective with that of homeless folks, you know, who were more influenced by the sin talk and sick talk. It's a complicated question. I mean, the first thing I'd like to say is, you know, you can't define people by what discourse they're into, right? I mean, it's not okay, the way things work. Obviously, some people are much more in one direction than another. But all of these ways of seeing homelessness were kind of floating around, you know, on the street in San Francisco, and people could, you know, would switch quite, you know, dramatically between them on occasion. And obviously, like, those who did have serious problems with physical and mental health were much, you know, the sick talk spoke to them much more. It spoke to their realities, you know, and so they were more likely to take it up.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It seemed, when you're describing the recyclers, that they seem more higher functioning and more resourceful than somebody who would be subscribing to a sick talk narrative, right? I mean, it just seemed like they were, it took a lot of resources, mental resources, to kind of figure out where you need to go and where can you set up camp. And I would just imagine that type of person, if saying a type of person exists, would be more open to a kind of a system analysis. But, and so I'm wondering, like, who was into the sick talk? Who was into the sin talk?
That's a great way of putting it. I mean, this is where my comparative work in St. Louis is actually pretty useful, because, you know, I got to hang out on the street scene there as well and sort of see how these ideas went down. I mean, what I would say is that, you know, if basically sick talk is absolutely, you know, dominant, you know, in the institutions that people are dealing with, and it's their only way to get any kind of resources, then, you know, everybody's going to get pulled into it to some extent. you know, what you have. So, for example, I mean, there's a study of a smaller town shelter by Vincent Lyon Callow, where, you know, he talks about the medicalization of poverty. So basically, the sick talk really wins. And so people who in San Francisco would have been these, say, higher functioning recycler types, perhaps, you know, are just like very depressed sort of shelter users who are sort of like, you know, gradually learning to, you know, express their narrative in terms of their depression, right? You know, which there's something, you know, of course some people might become homeless because they're depressed, but it's surely far more likely that people will become depressed because they're homeless, right? You know, it's like there's something not working with your brain if you don't become, you know, somewhat, you know, worried and anxious and down if, you know, with this massive downward mobility and loss of your life, right?
Yeah, obscuring the cause or the effect
right.
of one or
exactly.
the other.
Exactly. So, you know, you get a lot of weird sort of distortions of that causal direction going on. But I mean, in big cities, the sin talk tends to be much more powerful. And why? Well, you know, these are the people who are coming out of the mass incarceration experience, right? So, you know, of course, in California, they hold on to some folks for life, you know, but basically they're still churning on through. I'm talking about the three strikes and you're out policy, of course,
okay.
You know, which is quite horrendous in terms of like some of the very mild offenses people are doing life sentences for. But, you know, there's still most people who are going down for or have gone down for, you know, say like minor, you know, street drug dealing, for example, you know, they come out with no resources. They're brutalized by the, you know, the terrible conditions in the California prison system, and you know they've lost touch with their families often, or have very attenuated relationships with them, and a lot of them just go straight onto the street. You know, like some people go into halfway houses. If you've been in jail, which is what you'll do if you've done a shorter sentence, you know, you're quite likely to get tipped out of jail at 10 at night, you know, with nothing but your clothes, and not even your clothes if, you know, there's been some problem. I mean, often I would meet people who'd come out of jail and they'd be wearing hospital clothes and like those weird little slipper things they wear in operating theaters, and they'd be like, where are you come from? You have a hospital? No, like, no, I came from the jail, and this is all they would give me, you know. And so these people, you know, coming out in their thousands, you know, into the California cities with, you know, nowhere to go, and they're just joining the homeless population, and they, you know, they have been socialized often from a really young age to see themselves as bad guys. You know, they've been, you know, expelled from school. They've been in problems with, you know, say with the youth authority, and, you know, it for them, if they become homeless, they just take those same ideas that I'm a bad guy and that's okay because I'm a cool guy, right? You know, and they take those ideas out onto the streets, and they, you know, basically they, you know, they'll see themselves as being of the street but not on the street. They'll construct the street as a positive thing. And so in some ways, these are the group of homeless folks who have the most, the strongest idea of their own agency, their own ability to shape their world, because they've accepted, yes, they live on the, you know, on the outlaw side of the line, but, you know, these my streets, you know.
And I guess it's saying that, you know, the system didn't screw me. I'm screwing the system in a way. I'm in charge. It's a position of strength, really.
And they'll actually look at other people who are homeless and call them, you know, poor homeless motherfuckers, you know, just because they are, you know, they look more stereotypically homeless, like they have a shopping cart or something, you know?
And that's not them.
It's not, you know, yeah. So if they don't have a shopping cart and they're like hanging out sort of, you know, doing petty thievery, even if they're living in the shelters and often sleeping, you know, being kicked out of the shelters, not getting into the shelters, you know, there's never been enough shelter beds in San Francisco. But these folks will rarely see themselves as homeless, you know. And if they do construct themselves as homeless, it will be as part of a sort of working the system sort of discourse within, you know, some agency where they're trying to get some kind of resources. But they won't take it to heart. You know, they'll see themselves as being these sort of cunning players. I mean, I'd have people who would be like, yeah, I managed to, you know, scam some clothing from this lady in this agency. And I'd be like, oh, but that's what she's there for, to give clothing to people like you. Did you really scam her? You know, but this sort of, I came to admire it. You know, initially I was scared of these folks and sort of avoided them. Then I realized if I'm going to do this thing where I really look at the different ways of living homelessness, I need to get to know them. So I went and did all this field work with them. And I came to admire this fierce life spirit, which says, I'm going to take this position I'm in, which is absolutely at the bottom of the society. Many of these guys are African Americans. They've just been like demonized and, you know, despised all of their lives. And I'm going to say that I'm in charge of my world, and that I'm actually like I'm somebody to be reckoned with in my world, which is the street. And so I absolutely understand why people would orient themselves in that direction. And I think, you know, the mass incarceration is creating this vast criminalized, you know, group of folks who really, you know, can cause a lot of instability in the society, and partly, you know, this is why the homeless shelters and all of the other sort of helping industries, they have a huge job on their hands to try to get people to see their lives in terms of sick talk, when, you know, there's the vitality of this kind of sin talk model. You know, some of the most incredibly, you know, like damaged people that I've known absolutely refuse to have anything to do with the sick talk model. You know, people who are HIV positive, they have tuberculosis, they have abscesses in their arms, they're just suffering horribly, and they just won't have anything to do with it.
But I mean, how do they see recyclers though? Because I guess system talk does frame homelessness as victims themselves, and sick talk is also... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, you're a victim of your own mental illness.
Yes, so
did
absolutely.
People who embrace absolutely. This sin talk, do they see other homeless archetypes as more weaker individuals or people?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of my favorite bits in the book is kind of like a hilarious passage where, you know, I sort of have two guys talking about each other who, you know, who really distrust each other precisely across these kinds of lines. And so, you know, one of them is a, you know, a drug dealer, extremely minor drug dealer in the Tenderloin. And he's looking at, you know, another African American guy who's a recycler pushing through with this huge load. And, you know, basically, you know, he thinks that guy is just like hilariously delusional, because he's like pretending that he's like a city worker. You know, he's like, you know, where's he getting off on? You know, this is hilarious. You know, what an idiot. You know, he's doing all of this hard work. So basically, you know, he sees this kind of pathetic attempt to look part of the mainstream of society when they can't possibly do it.
Yeah.
And that I should just recognize he's like another despised, you know, black crack addict, basically. And the other guy is, you know, don't go anywhere near so and so. He's, you know, he's not to be trusted. He's, you know, he's just a bad guy. So, you know, an absolute gulf there, you know, in terms of, you know, their whole orientation to what homelessness is, who they are, you know, what they're doing there, what the role of the society is in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny as you're saying that, I'm having a flashback to my social work days where I used to be a case manager and sometimes trying to help these homeless teens get jobs. And I remember one of my clients said, oh, I'm not going to be a sucker and work at McDonald's, you know, like I can make a lot more money stealing from these suckers who work at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. But I remember wanting him to make this switch of like, you know, stop embracing this whole identity as this bad guy. But it really did give this person who had otherwise nothing a sense of power, you know, as pathetic as I wanted him to see that.
The story
you just gave about him, you know, scamming this woman that was giving him clothes. I mean, that's exactly what I would see all the time. Like these little scams that from my perspective seem really pathetic, you know, like you're scamming the people who are trying to help you, but it was consistent with the identity mm-hmm. that they were cultivating for themselves.
Yeah, and you know, our popular culture totally encourages that, right? You know, I mean, there's been this sort of commodification of deviance, really since the counterculture in American society, which, you know, it's like these outlaw images, you know, like obviously, you know, gangster stuff to some extent. It basically glamorizes, you know, life on the other side of the line. So even like the most, you know, sad kind of homeless crack addict who does like a little bit of crime can kind of see themselves as being a gangster figure. I mean, there's nothing, of course, these archetypes are very old, you know, Jesse James or Stagger Lee or whatever, you know, it goes way back in American culture. But I think it's been kind of turbocharged by the appetite of suburban kids for like these images. Yeah.
There's a way in which it really is emasculating for them. To say, you know, let's talk about your problems. Let's talk about how you have bipolar or you're depressed. And they have to make the switch, as I was saying. You know, they have to kind of be willing to be okay to talk about their emotions. But it's a tricky transformation, I would say. In reading your book, if that's the only way you can get into a shelter, you know, if you have to take up this language, then maybe that's what you'll do. And maybe you'll do it for a little bit and then you'll leave and then you'll say that you were scamming. I mean, did you see some of that where people were kind of embracing sick talk for a little while and then they would leave and then embrace kind of a sin talk?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, this is the most common phenomenon. And anyone who's like lived on the streets in San Francisco will tell you this, that the people who are, you know, often it's the people who are the most sort of like avid system workers inside of the shelters, like those who will kind of talk the talk the most loudly and sort of, you know, fervently, are the people who, you know, will sell you crack in the bathroom. You know, this is the stereotype, and there's a lot of truth to it. And it's partly because, you know, folks who are doing this kind of flip backwards and forwards, you know, they're not liars, they're tricksters. You know, they have a trickster identity, which is just like, it's all a game for them. It's not, you know, they don't see themselves as being liars at all. They're like, hey, you know, I can do this emotion work to get this thing. Look at me do it. I'm good at it.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, whereas people who are actually more, really more attracted to sick talk, you know, which has included quite a lot of the white guys that I worked with, I would say, you know, did feel that they had long-term issues with mental health, you know, and substance abuse. But they found the whole process so demeaning. They couldn't reduce the complexity of their suffering as homeless people to those things. They knew it was much more complicated than that. And so when I should make a differentiation here, you know, we're talking, of course, about, you know, single men's experience here. So it's very, very different from other folks' experience in shelters because they have a different character. But basically, there's a huge difference between the emergency shelter situation where it's just kind of like mats on the floor, not many questions asked, and the more guaranteed housing, you know, offered by these sort of transitional programs. And it's really in the transitional programs where, in order to sort of guarantee a bed for a month or longer, you know, they would have to basically construct a biography which, you know, which explained their homelessness in terms of, you know, one or more major, you know, personal flaws. And so for a lot of the guys, it was substance abuse that they had to, you know, they had to put down, not necessarily because they were out of control users, but because they it had to be one of these things, you know. So basically, in order to be working on their issues, they needed to have the right kinds of issues. And so it was almost a default thing that anybody who didn't have physical mental health problems, which, you know, loomed larger, would sort of fall into the substance abuse bracket, and they would have to sort of sit around, you know, talking about their substance abuse issues and, you know, attend meetings. And, you know, basically, if they wanted housing out of these transitional housing programs, the best road to getting it was to actually move into full-time rehab. Right. So, you know, the guys who that I worked with who, like, the white guys who were most attracted to sick talk, they were interested in reassessing their lives in these ways to some extent, but they found it, you know, too reductionist, too authoritarian, and they just weren't able to really pick up on it that well. They found themselves getting so irritated by the rule systems, by the fact that they were being kind of, there was all of these folks they saw as sort of lying system workers who were, you know, just bullshitting around them and yeah, trying to sell them crack, you know, the whole scene was just too depressing to them. So that the only time they would really talk about this stuff, they wouldn't talk about it with each other. They would, you know, they'd really just like talk to me about it or talk to like a medical doctor about it. So ironically, it was medical doctors and nurses were like the only people that they were really talking about their issues with, even if those issues were mental health or substance issues, because they felt that that relationship was less demeaning, which I find very interesting. There's something about the one size fits all experience of, you know, sort of mandatory type 12-step you know, processes in these, you know, sort of degraded situations like, you know, public shelters, which is just extremely off-putting to people who you know, serious about their issues, I think.
I mean, it's almost like there's a pop psychology culture that you're describing within these shelters that kind of blend a little bit of sin talk, sick talk together. It might be very different than what we think of kind of middle-class notions of one-on-one therapy, where you have this kind of unconditional positive regard by your therapist. I mean, because that's what I conceive of as getting mental health services, right? But what you're describing sounds like group settings where you're not forced, but you're kind of encouraged to, like you said, describe your biography in a way where mental health or substance abuse plays kind of the dominant role in why you're poor and why you're homeless and what's really preventing you, which is, it's a different type of mental health experience than I think what most people would think of.
You know, really the kind of sort of authoritarian pop psychology that you get, you know, in prisons and homeless shelters, you know, around issues of anger, substance abuse, you know, domestic violence to some extent. It's a completely different kind of model of the therapeutic, and it's cheap. I mean, that's the first thing that I, you know, maybe I'm just being some kind of Marxist, but, you know, ultimately, you know, I think that's the most notable thing about it. You know, this is like one relatively unskilled person who, you know, probably has an associate degree, you know, in addiction studies or something at the most, you know, running a group with like, you know, 15 to 30 people, you know, that's not like a highly trained, you know, mental health professional dealing with the intricacies of one person's problems. It's, you can't, you know, really look at the specificities when you're doing that. Basically, people have to start, you know, just intoning a homogenous biography where, you know, in the case of homeless folks, that the street is, it's the zone of denial. That's what homelessness is. It's nothing to do with homelessness, like being deprived of home. It's to do with being too oriented towards drug use, and, you know, with the street as the place where the drug use, you know, is where you buy it, where you use it, you know, and that basically, you know, you have to turn your back on the street in this sort of symbolic way, which is turning your back on substance abuse. And this picture is so ridiculously simplistic for people who've been struggling with long-term, you know, houselessness and homelessness, you know, housing marginality, that it just infuriates them, you know?
Right. Well, because they have more immediate needs.
Yeah, they you know, exactly. I mean, they have more immediate needs, and they know that there's different out there's out there, that in fact, you know, the out there of the street is divided, you know, into all of these little zones. You know, some of them are spaces of denial and out of control drug use. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, others are not. And, you know, it's there's a whole world out there, and to construct everything is just being like, you know, basically the entire sort of non-domesticated yeah. zone, a place where a lot of people just feel dumped, you know, to construct it as a sort of glorified shooting gallery just doesn't make any sense to people who are homeless.
Hmm. Well, I mean, that's the thing I'm kind of curious about, because wouldn't medicalization kind of absolve some guilt?
There's empathy offered. It would be ridiculous to say that there wasn't. But it's not a reprieve. You know, it's still basically a moralistic model, one that you can, you know, you can turn your life around.
Right.
And there's definitely a whole kind of culture of empathy within AA and NA, which can be really powerful for some people. But it's a total mistake to see this as a shift in register from moral to medical. I mean, as I said, it has very little to do with doctors and indeed what doctors research or think about addiction, you know, which has shifted towards, you know, these neurochemical interpretations. Instead, it's very much kind of still with the AA model and the kind of institutionalized
right.
AA model of, you know, started by Synanon, the therapeutic community, which basically teaches you to be a new person by instilling a new morality through cognitive reorientation and new behaviors through behavior modification. And so basically, you know, if you take the road off the street, which is the only one really offered to you if you're an able-bodied single man, and go for, you know, a lengthy rehab process, this is what you're expected to do, is to basically have your identity claims, mm-hmm. your whole personality just sort of stripped down to nothing and rebuilt as somebody who's got the will, the self-discipline, and the right mm-hmm. kind of moral orientation to turn their back on the street, as the street as the place of bad behavior and bad people, and become this, you know, new productive domesticated person. It's understood by the people within it as, you know, basically a life transformation, which kind of it changes your moral orientation and teaches you how to do normal, you know. So basically, I think they would say. Hey, no, it's not superficial at all. Actually, this is the deepest kind of transformation possible that we're offering to people. You know, but it's an intervention which is, you know, the vast majority of the intervention is, you know, in the person themselves to try to make them into a better and more functional person. And so, you know, the intervention is not on the conditions they're living in, right? So, and wow, that's a lot to ask of people, especially if they don't even map what's happened to them in that way at all, you know. It's really a very difficult journey. And I mean, of my, you know, 35 or so folks that I really managed to follow quite long term, as like only one person sort of made it through that route.
Really?
The guys themselves had a pretty good picture of this. At least some of the folks, the recycling folks did. So for example, this one conversation that I actually recorded, Pipe was talking to his friend Manny, and he sort of said, if those politicians in City Hall really want to help us, why don't they just give us housing, or at least let folks camp in peace without being kicked around by idiot cops? I'll tell you why. Because all their friends running the shelters and all those other programs lose their jobs. Hmm. Ain't that the truth, said Manny. But Manny actually took this line of thought further, kind of portraying the disease model of homelessness as a kind of social control which would prevent any kind of collective action. And he said, it's not just about the money, you know. Those shelters will break you down. They want us all shelterized, you know, like depressed and sniffling around, snitching on each other. That's the idea. They don't want another tent city on Civic Center, for sure. And they reckon these new style shelters, that's the best way to do it. Then they don't even need the cops. Yeah, so I mean, you know, this is a pretty radical argument. And you know, quite honestly, when I first heard this kind of talk, I thought it was, you know, like, well, perhaps it's kind of conspiracy theory kind of reaction to it, which I later came to, you know, to reject. And I realized that they, you know, they were right, that there was this close connection, as in the example I gave you about the clearance under the bridge, right?
Right, where it gets kind of co-opted as a as a way of social control. I mean, he even says social control. And, you know, if the staff at the shelter are themselves ex-homeless people, it's really a type of self-control where there's a system that's being set up where the homeless control themselves and are out of sight and into shelters.
Yeah, warehoused, basically, you know. You know, one of the arguments you probably remember from the book is that I make is when in the latter part of the book I'm sort of talking more about the institutional level and like the politics of homelessness in San Francisco. I sort of arguing that the policing campaigns and the way that homelessness is constructed in the shelters really sort of start to work together in a way so that those kind of different ways of seeing homelessness aren't so separate. And so one of the examples that I picked up on early on, because it really struck me, was that a homeless clearance, which was happening, you know, from some folks living under a bridge, got basically discussed as sort of helping to save them from themselves in the press by both the police and by the guy who was running the local shelter. The idea that because they, you know, that letting people live in an encampment is basically enabling them. So basically, what this does is it justifies any act of police clearance or like brutality, like smashing up the more autonomous ways that people try to make these makeshift shanty towns, just like the poor people of the global south, right? I mean, it's like, this is what I would do if I were homeless. I would not be in a shelter from what I've seen. I mean, unless it was a really nice one, you know, especially if I was a guy, which I'm not, you know, I would be out there trying to make my little shanty or whatever. But this kind of convergence of sin talk and sick talk, what it does is it justifies cleansing this incredibly valuable space in the case of San Francisco, this global city of all of this, you know, human trash, under the guise of being kind to the human trash, you know, and saving them from themselves, right? You know, so we shouldn't be enabling these poor people need us. So Gavin Newsom, who is being like the absolute, you know, leader of this approach, you know, in San Francisco, the mayor there, you know, he came in to office with this very different discourse from the previous I'm cracking down on homelessness guy, who was an ex-police chief, Frank Jordan, in the early 90s. So Gavin Newsom comes in, you know, and it's all like, we have to help these people. And of course, everybody would agree with that, right? We have to help these people. But a lot of his having to help these people has been about, you know, making it just too hot to handle to be out on the streets. The idea is, you know, we're going to have the programs in place and, you know, you're going to be part of those programs. And if you don't want to be part of those programs, you don't want to work on your issues, and therefore we're gonna make it impossible for you to live outside. You know, and then I only realized this when I was sort of finishing the book, but I think a lot of what you see in the you know, the street ethnography, which is like the whole sort of large middle section of the book, is like how important stable encampments are to people. That in fact, you know, all the people who have like a bearable life as homeless people are people who are not being disrupted every day or every 3 days, you know, by having their, you know, all of their stuff thrown in a garbage truck or, you know, like basically not being around the same people, right? It's people who actually manage to make these tiny little safe spaces for themselves, you know, who psychically survive far more than the people in the shelters, you know. And the homeless folks in San Francisco, whether they're inside the shelters or not, they have a strong critique of what it does to people. It's a bit like, you know what I feel reluctant to say this perhaps, but you know, the idea of what happened to people in concentration camps, they become these sort of half people, but they talk about people being shelterized and like just these sort of shuffling passive people, you know, a bit like say, Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest after he's had his lobotomy or something. I mean, this is how they construct the shelterized person who spent too long just like in the lines, just passively taking it and is checking out more and more, you know, psychically. So there's really not a person left.
But I think in closing, I just want to say I enjoyed the book. I think just because you're honest about what you observed in the streets, and I think you also raise up, you know, these three conventional ways. You said simplistic, but I think it's they're ways of mm-hmm. the scheme helps you understand the ways that homelessness has been constructed, but then it helps you kind of challenge these ideas. So even as this kind of housing first advocate that I'm finding myself becoming, you have to still kind of, the book reminds you to even question that, because it seems like, especially when you're working with vulnerable populations, that
right.
even the nicest mm-hmm. discourses can be co-opted, you know. So our discussion for a while about the kind of pop medicalization, you know, yeah, mental health services for people who need it sounds like a great thing, but it could so easily be used as mm-hmm. justification for, you know, tearing down encampments in mm-hmm. the middle of downtown
right.
or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah, thanks. And yeah, I hope people go out and buy the book and highly recommend it.
Well, thanks so much, Arturo.
You've been listening to an interview with Teresa Gowan, author of Hobos, Hustlers, and Backsliders, Homeless in San Francisco, published by the University of Minnesota Press. I've been your host, Arturo Baiocchi, for the New Books in Sociology podcast, part of the New Books Network. Hopefully you enjoy the episode and the interview, and we'll see you next time.